the New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Hello again and welcome to the show. Coming up, changes to the gun laws in the Parliament and the federal government announces a gas reservation scheme. All that and a whole lot more coming up. You can always send us a text. 0467 922 684 is the number to text me here at the Country Hour. But first up today, let's turn our attention to guns. That's the issue on the agenda. Independent MP Roy Butler and the New South Wales Nationals oppose new firearm reform legislation being introduced in New South Wales Parliament today. They say the New South Wales Labor government has failed to meaningfully consult with regional communities and instead cynically attempting to conflate new laws banning hate symbols with a distinctly separate issue of gun reform. This is not a gun problem, says Roy Butler. It's an Islamic extremist problem. He says he supports measures to strengthen hate speech laws, but that issue should not be conflated with law-abiding gun ownership. He says that is offensive to thousands of law-abiding, honest firearm owners and a disgraceful smokescreen for what was a government failure. I asked Roy Butler a short time ago if he'd been able to negotiate any amendments with the Minns government.
No changes, Michael. And unfortunately, the government seems hell-bent on trying to ram these laws through the Parliament without any real process, without any consultation, without any evidence. I know, and I won't mention names because, you know, I don't want to betray trust, but there's a lot of members of the Labor Party who are really, really concerned about what the government's doing. So this is not just a concern that's coming from me. This is concerns from, you know, pretty much across the Parliament. In fact, I was talking to someone yesterday who talked about a Greens councillor in a regional seat who owns 8 firearms, who would obviously be impacted directly by these rule changes. So this is bigger than just a couple of people being impacted. There's 260,000 licence holders in New South Wales. There's 18,000 of those are in my electorate, over 18,000 actually. And you've got to remember, in regional New South Wales, we don't have theatres, we don't have stage shows, we don't have the Domain, we don't have theme parks, all that sort of thing. And a lot of people get a lot of satisfaction from recreating by going to a gun club, a pistol club, a rifle club, and it's a very social thing for them, you know. Like, and I remember during the drought, there was days we'd go to the pistol club at Gilgandra when I was the captain of that club. Days we'd go to the club and we wouldn't even get the guns out. We'd get there and we'd spend 2 hours, 3 hours just talking, because those farmers that were coming off properties, they were struggling. They were surrounded by negativity and dry paddocks and stock that were poor or had to get rid of their stock. The pistol club or the gun club provided an outlet. It provided an opportunity to go and talk to people and do something that was definitely of a benefit to people's mental well-being. But it wasn't with the stigma of, you know, therapy and that sort of thing. So I just don't think the government really has a grasp of regional New South Wales' relationship with firearms and doesn't understand that we're not exercised by firearms. We're not really worried about firearms. We are worried about extremism, radicalisation, anti-Semitism and terrorism. That's obviously a concern for everyone. But people in my electorate, by and large, don't look at the tragic event that happened at Bondi on the 14th and worry about guns. They worry about how the people that committed that atrocity got firearms. How did they access firearms? You know, if one of them was on an ASIO watch list, and we know both of them were allegedly in a terrorist training camp in the Philippines for a month prior to the incident. They only got back a week before.
And yet, when you listen to the city media, they say 4 guns for people living in the city or big centres that are not attached to farming, and 10 guns for farmers. So the consensus seems to be that seems reasonable.
Well, that's a total lack of understanding of how firearms work and how they're used. I mean, you need a gun that fits you. It's a bit like a running shoe or golf clubs. They need to actually fit your physique. The people who participate in pistol target shooting, in clay target shooting or recreational hunting, they are not the problem. They are not the people who are out there, you know, with radicalisation.
So you think it's an intelligence failure more than anything else?
It's 100%. Like, if this guy was on an ASIO watch list back, almost 10 years ago, the father was able to apply for a firearms licence twice and get a photo advice. They've gone to a terrorist training camp in the Philippines and come back and committed this horrible thing at Bondi. I think that's absolutely an intelligence failure. I think it's there's a lot of failures. I don't know how or why the guy was given a license. He shouldn't have been given a license. And I think most people would say, well, if we've got concerns about someone, we should not be issuing them a license.
What about the idea that this is also a way of clamping down on organised crime too, and you know, stopping the guns that we're seeing in Western Sydney?
Well, look, Michael. Last time I checked, the criminals and the criminal gangs, they don't actually follow the laws. That's the key thing that makes them criminal gangs and criminal groups. They don't follow laws. So the laws that we're changing are only going to impact on the law abiding within the state. They're not going to impact on people who were not going to follow the law in the first place. You know, tougher penalties are great. I'm all for more penalties for organised crime and for people doing the wrong thing. Absolutely, no problems at all. But keep in mind that only law-abiding people follow laws.
So what should be the limit for guns then? No limit or tougher licensing regulations? What would you be calling for?
Well, what I would say is that if the firearms are stored in accordance with the safe storage requirements based on their category and based on the type of firearm they are, all that sort of thing, what's the public safety risk? Like, as an individual, as a firearms license holder, I can only carry, you know, one, maybe two firearms, if I'm lucky, at a time. I can only use two. But the point is that you need different firearms, different calibers, different types of firearms for different, not only target shooting events, but also to humanely dispatch animals. You need different calibers and types of firearms. I mean, you're not going to use a giant centerfire rifle like a 50 BMG to shoot rabbits. You know, you need something smaller. And also there's noise considerations and cost considerations as well. It's not about the numbers of firearms, Michael. It's about the people who have access to firearms. And in this case, I believe the state and federal governments have failed in allowing these people to have access to firearms. I mean, only one of these guys was licensed, right? The other one was clearly not licensed. But when you look at the footage, and having been in the military and trained and you know, been around firearms all my life, looking at these guys operate firearms, I can tell that they're trained. I can tell that they're quite proficient in the use of the firearms. And unfortunately, they use that for a horrible purpose in Bondi. But I just think we need to get back to the facts here. The facts are that 260,000 firearm owners in New South Wales, licence holders, they don't do the wrong thing.
What about the requirement? Is it still part of the legislation or proposed part of the bill that any firearm owner, including farmers, need to be a member of a gun club?
Yeah, look, I think that's crazy.
I mean, farmers are really, really upset about that.
If a farmer's 300 kilometres from the nearest gun club, what are we saying? That, you know, how many times a year, maybe twice, four times a year, this farmer's got to jump in his car and drive a six-hour return trip just to go to the range? I mean, they're living on a farm where they're using firearms. We making them go to a range doesn't actually do anything to improve public safety. In fact, there's a strong argument to say that taking that firearm out of the safe storage, putting it in a car, transporting it the round trip to the range and back is actually a negative for public safety because there's a firearm that's outside of safe storage. This needs to go to inquiry. This needs to go to a proper inquiry. Slow it down. Let the experts from all sides of the argument come in and give their evidence, whether they're anti-gun or pro-gun. I don't really care. I mean, the purpose of the democratic process is that we hear from everyone and then we make our mind up based on the evidence what we think is a way forward that tries to satisfy as many of the concerns that have been raised through the evidence that we've gathered. We haven't done any of that. There's no evidence in this. This is just knee-jerk reaction to what I absolutely acknowledge is a horrible, horrible incident at Bondi.
And yet, I mean, you say you'd like to see some changes to the legislation, maybe go off and have an inquiry into it. There doesn't seem to be the political will for that. It seems likely they're going to rush it through. What changes are you going to call for or amendments in the House if that happens?
Oh, look, I've got a stack of amendments, but Michael, what you've got to understand and your listeners need to understand is in the lower house, we simply won't have the numbers. In the lower house, the government only needs one. And Alex Greenwich, the member for Sydney, has already committed to the government that he will give them supply on this. So what that means is that in the lower house, we can try and do everything, and I will try and do everything.
But you can debate it. You can put up ideas.
100%. Yeah. 100%. And I will be. I will be, absolutely.
And sometimes that shifts the chamber.
Well, the problem we've got, Michael, and this is what my discussions with the police minister, with other ministers and other members of the government is that Cabinet has made a decision. Once Cabinet makes a decision, the only way to undo that is for Cabinet to make a different decision. So that's the problem we're facing. And really the only opportunity we've got to change this realistically is in the upper house. At the moment, it's a cognate bill, which means it comes through as one. So the public order or public assembly stuff is combined with the firearm stuff. What I've asked for is for the two to be split so that we can actually deal with the public order stuff, which I think can go through both houses. I don't think anyone's going to push back too hard on that, maybe the Greens. But the firearm stuff, I think, has been too rushed, and it needs just to be slowed down and go through inquiry. Nothing that we do today is going to impact on public safety for months or years. This is not going to be an immediate change. It's not like there's going to be vans, police vans, going around picking up firearms, before Christmas. This is something that is going to take months or years, and for that reason, we should do it properly. We should slow it down. We should speak to people, gather evidence, and come up with some sensible recommendations that might actually impact public safety, as opposed to what we've got in front of us at the moment, which has nothing to do with public safety.
Roy Butler is the member for Barwon. Well, talking about the gun legislation, the Premier Chris Minns is actually giving a press conference as we speak, talking about the response to the Bondi Beach shootings and changes to gun laws and also protest laws. And Sean Tarrant-Goodwin is an ABC reporter based in Parliament House who joins us now. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
So what's the Premier saying about the numbers that they have in getting these gun laws through?
Well, Michael, there was a bit of movement this morning on this. The Liberal Party announced that they would support the laws and vote for them. The National Party split off in the coalition to say that it'll actually vote against it. But as your guest Roy just said before, in terms of the government's majority, it has a one-seat minority in the lower house, and Alex Greenwich has previously said he'll support it. So it was expected to pass that house today. But with the support of the Liberal Party, it'll pass, or it's got a pathway now through both houses.
And the Nationals have also split from the coalition on this. They're opposed to these gun laws in particular. What's their criticism?
Well, the National Party said that it supports the protest and hate speech side of the bill, but as you said, is opposed to the gun laws component. They said that there's been insufficient consultation with key regional and primary producer stakeholders on this. It said the Minns Labor government failed to consult key regional stakeholders, including the New South Wales Farmers and the Country Mayors Association. It said in a statement, the National Party said, we cannot support a bill that relies on arbitrary limits and does not give our regional businesses the tools they need to do their jobs. The New South Wales Farmers Association also gave a press conference this morning. It said that farmers need more than 10 firearms. Some of them work across different properties, and it makes it hard for them to undertake pest control. Also, on the idea of recreational hunting restrictions, they said that recreational hunters actually help to reduce feral populations in those areas. So it's that's important for their efforts on pest control. So the Nationals have split off from the coalition on this. But given the way that the numbers fall in both houses with the support of the Liberals, it is expected to pass.
Yeah, so we're hearing that talk about 10 firearms for farmers. And is it still, the legislation is still talking about 4 firearms maximum for people that live in cities or big town centres?
Yeah, that's right. The government's proposing to impose a cap of 4 firearms per individual with exemptions for primary producers and sports shooters who might hold up to 10 firearms. There's a number of other components to the gun laws, reducing the frequency of review of a firearms license down from 5 years down to 2 years, removing NCAT as an appeal pathway if a license is being removed, restricting firearms licenses to Australian citizens only, with a carve-out for New Zealand permanent residents if they're engaged in roles such as primary production or security, and also making gun club membership mandatory for all firearms license holders, with the ability to exempt certain license holders under the regulations. What that specifically means in terms of primary producers as well, that's a little unclear at the moment, so we're trying to get across that detail today.
Yeah, that's one thing that the New South Wales farmers have been bitterly opposed to, and we heard there from Roy Butler saying that's ridiculous, a ridiculous imposition on farmers if they have to actually join a gun club, which the closest might be several hundred kilometres away, for example. There's also some talk about it'll go through the lower house by the looks of things. Any chance or any talk about any amendments in the upper house?
So the Liberal Party has flagged that there may be some amendments that they might propose, but we don't know exactly what those might be at the moment. As I said before, they have said that they will support the bills writ large, so it's possible that they could just pass completely unamended.
Okay, we'll have to wait and see how that pans out. Appreciate your time on the program today, Sean.
Thank you.
It's coming up to 20 minutes past 12 here on the New South Wales Country Hour. Getting a few texts on that. Tom at Coromel says, simple solution to gun laws, tag them like you do with ankle bracelets. Also, other issues here, talking about, oh, yeah, saying this discussion about the belt-fed firearms, and Callum saying there aren't any like that. So someone who's talking about that or was advising about that is very much ill-informed. But Greg in Ningen says he thinks 10 guns for each farming enterprise is more than adequate in terms of pest control and the number that people need. So he says people who enjoy shooting animals for so-called sport are a part of a yesteryear era, says Greg. And, yeah, there's a whole bunch of... Oh, someone else, Dave in Trundle, says we don't need a knee-jerk reaction from city-based politicians dictating gun laws for rural New South Wales. You're listening to the New South Wales Country Hour. It's coming up to 21 minutes past 12.
The New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Seasonal workers in a prominent New South Wales cherry orchard are claiming they were unfairly denied an end-of-season bonus and were exposed to squalid living conditions. The workers who want to remain anonymous pick fruit for Hallmark cherries during the 2024 summer harvest. The ABC has seen 10 written complaints and has spoken directly with four of the workers, including one man who is an Australian citizen and an experienced picker. David Claughton filed this report.
The worker, we'll call him Joe, says conditions at Hallmark Cherries near Young in New South Wales were terrible. He collected statements from nine other workers who all complained about the conditions and said the company underpaid them. Joe says it came to a head just before the end of the season, when workers were expecting a bonus payment of $1,000 to $2,000 if they completed the season right up to the final day.
That night before the final day, he sent out a message to the group chat in WhatsApp to all the pickers, and he said, anybody thinking of leaving even up to 1 hour before the end of the season will not be paid their bonus. So all of us, as many of us could, stayed until the very end. A week later, when we should be receiving that pay, they sent an email out saying, due to decisions that we have made, we will not be paying anybody their bonus.
Nobody got their bonus. So we're talking 60 people, so somewhere between $60,000 and $120,000 bonuses.
So there was, there was maybe 12 returning Australians that got their bonus, that have been working for that company year after year, and then they didn't pay anybody else their bonus.
Now, let's just look at your case. What did you do that meant that they argued they didn't have to pay you the bonus?
I did nothing. I worked every day. I never called in sick. I never complained. I did the right thing, and I don't know why they're doing this.
So are you taking this to a lawyer? Are you preparing some legal action?
I've taken it to Legal Aid. I've called Fair Work. I've called Safe Work. I've called the Magistrates Court. I've called everyone I can, but I can't seem to get any help.
Do they have a history of not paying bonuses? Like, is this repeat behaviour as far as you're
aware? This is repeat behaviour, and this particular farm is notorious for kind of doing this type of thing.
Joe says the company doesn't respect its employees.
I'd never found any respect from these people to this. Any issue brought, it's met with just this feeling that they don't give a shit, you know?
So what are you going to do next then?
Oh, look, it's kind of left me with a sour taste in my mouth. I don't feel like I want to continue in this industry for a bit, because it's quite a common story, you know? I think they had this idea that it's foreign workers that don't have a general sense of their working rights, that they can keep getting away with stuff like this.
Hallmark charges the 60 workers in the team a total of $6,000 a week for accommodation, but Joe says it was substandard.
It's kind of just a dusty field, no trees. They supply drinking water and facilities, but the facilities are not maintained. They have broken down for up to a week in 40-degree heat, in torrential weather.
So you're paying $80 a week for that service, and they didn't repair stuff when it was reported?
Some of us have gone directly face-to-face at the office and brought up this issue. There's also a WhatsApp group that a few people posted in directly to the boss, and this issue was not resolved. it was not really taken into consideration and nobody really seems to care. So it took almost up to a week to get these facilities kind of running again.
Safe Work say they investigated the reports between November and December last year relating to working conditions and underpayment and found the allegations were unable to be substantiated. That surprised other workers who've backed up Joe's complaints.
No way.
This worker, who's a permanent citizen of Australia, also wants to remain anonymous because he's still employed in the sector.
Yeah, well, such a weird farm, mate.
What do you mean weird?
Just not like any farms I've ever been to, you know? Lack of care and no water. Unusable toilets, you know? It's like if you really desperately need a toilet, like, it's just dirty and, like, there's beetles and bugs everywhere, just like when we were showering and, like, cobwebs and...
And what about the end-of-season bonus? Were you one of those that worked to the end but didn't get paid?
Yes, correct, yeah. The deal was you stay until the end of the season and you get paid your bonus, you know? And I did that. I picked clean, like, there was a bunch of people in that team that was picking horribly.
But you were penalised for that yourself because
yeah,
you were part of that team.
Yeah.
He said some of the casuals were pushed to work without adequate breaks.
They were dodging breaks, like these kids were just like working like a dog, you know, all through without like much breaks, like probably 5 minute breaks and then get back on it.
And was that their choice or was that the employer telling them they had to keep working
through? It was the employers telling them to work through. It's like... You can't have a break, you got to keep going. One of the kids quit and then, like, yeah, he was going to Fair Work and...
And what did Fair Work do about that? They made a complaint, was there an outcome?
Yeah, they changed the payment and they made it fair for the Lug Boys.
Right. So in the end, what do you think about this particular employer? Others have said that they didn't care about their workers and that this is repeat behaviour, it happens every season.
Yeah. I honestly think they don't care about their workers. They just want to get their fruit off. They don't even pay on time, you know.
Another female worker here on a tourist visa but with lots of experience as a picker says she was also treated without respect.
They don't see us as human beings, like it feels to that sense. It's like there's a lack of humanity. It's just you're here to make money for us and pick our fruit, so we don't really care for the quality of life that you have whilst you're here, you know.
And what's your situation? Are you on a tourist visa? Are you needing your 88 days?
I've already done all of that. I'm from the UK, so I've been here for a few years now. I'm not yet a permanent resident, but I've been cherry picking for about 4 years, and this is definitely one of the worst farms I've ever experienced in my life.
Hallmark Cherries and the labour firm that manages the workers, North Kopang Limited, have not responded to the ABC's calls and emails. The Fair Work Ombudsman commenced an investigation into North Kopang in July 2025 after the ABC raised the workers' concerns. The ABC sought documents relating to that investigation through a Freedom of Information application and found there were 13 contacts to the Fair Work Ombudsman about Hallmark and North Kopang between 2019 and 2025. Including 10 inquiries and 2 disputes that were referred for further investigation. A final investigation letter released to the ABC showed the Fair Work Ombudsman found no breaches of the Fair Work Act 2009 or the Horticultural Award 2020. The workers were paid the minimum wage as required, but the Ombudsman said the bonus payment was outside their jurisdiction as bonuses are not mandated within the awards. The workers would have to pursue that matter through the courts, but few backpackers or seasonal workers bother to make a claim as there are costs involved and most are moving on to other jobs or heading back to their own countries. The Fair Work Ombudsman will not be taking further action in relation to this matter.
David Claughton with that report on seasonal workers in the New South Wales cherry industry.
You're with Michael Condon for the New South Wales Country Hour on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Shortly we'll have some weather details, but before we do that, the federal government has announced there'll be a gas reservation scheme operating on the east coast of Australia from 2027. Manufacturers have been calling for relief from rising energy costs that they've blamed on too much gas being sold overseas. Energy Minister Chris Bowen described it as a historic announcement and said it would reserve between 15 to 25% of the supply, which will put downward pressure on prices.
Most Australians think that Australians should have first rights to the gas that's under Australian soil, Australian waters, and that gas should be available to Australians at reasonable prices. And Australians are right about that. Most Australians think it makes no sense that Australia can be one of the largest gas producers and exporters in the world, and yet we have report after report showing us that there are gas shortages for domestic use in coming years. And Australians are right about that as well. So today, after months of consultation with Minister Madeleine King, I'm announcing with Minister Ayres, who's acting Resources Minister as well as being Industry Minister, that the Albanese government will now move towards a gas reservation policy for Australia. A policy based on a preferred model of export permits for our three gas exporting companies and indeed anybody else who proposes to export gas in the future. We've consulted on various models, we've consulted on various options, but we've decided to support as a preferred model for further consultation the simplest, easiest to implement, easiest to understand model of not allowing gas exports into the future unless the government is satisfied that domestic demand is catered for first. And we believe that that can be achieved by a national reservation of 15 to 25%, which we are consulting on from today. We believe that this is good policy based on our experience from Western Australia over recent decades, which has developed a strong and robust gas industry, which has exported but has also catered for Western Australia's needs. This would represent a reservation of 15 to 25%, 200 to 350 petajoules a year, which our advice is would be enough not only to cater for the domestic shortfalls that are forecast, but obviously to slightly oversupply the Australian domestic market, which is the right policy approach. Importantly, this policy will apply only prospectively to new contracts, not existing contracts, not contracts that have been entered into by, in good faith, by our trading partners and our gas companies, but to new contracts. No existing contract, domestic or international, would be disturbed or cancelled under this policy. However, it's also important to make clear that we are proposing that this policy apply from today. And that's one of the reasons why Minister Ayres and I have made the difficult decision to proceed with the announcement today, because we need to provide certainty to the Australian industry that contracts entered into from today will need to ensure adequate domestic supply going forward. We have shortages forecast in coming years, not next year, but in years after that. And so it's important that this policy start to operate. It will operate from 2027, but will apply from today in terms of any new contracts entered into by our gas companies.
That's the Energy Minister Chris Bowen announcing a gas reservation scheme from 2027. It will include an export permit system which will aim to reserve 15 to 25% of the supply between 250 and 300 petajoules of gas. And it applies, as the Minister just said, to new contracts from today. It's coming up to 27 minutes to one and it's time to find out what's happening with the weather details. Brandon Cray's at the Bureau. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Michael.
So much happening in terms of the weather. I know we had some rain on the weekend and farmers in the south particularly were pretty happy with that. Is there more on the way or is it heating up or what's happening?
So the rain at the moment is kind of draped across the northeastern quarter of the state and we do have a severe thunderstorm warning embedded within that just for the upper western along the Queensland border. We also have some heat lingering still north of Sydney along the coast. A severe heatwave warning remains in effect. But as we go into tomorrow, that risk will all contract further to the northeast as the rain pushes and thunderstorms push further into the northeast and become largely dry across the rest of the state. Looking ahead then into the Christmas period, it's going to become mostly settled, but some coastal cloud and some light showers may dampen some people's expectations of a perfect beach day for Christmas. And then the further outlook then is for it to remain settled into the weekend.
Right, so not too much heat on the way or anything like that, and some showers persisting by the sound of things in some parts.
Yeah, the easterly winds should cool things down for midweek, much cooler than what we've had recently.
Right, okay. So, but we're talking showers. We're not talking like a large amount of rain.
No, just showers is what the forecast is bringing for the moment.
And temperatures pretty mild.
Temperatures around the average for December for New South Wales, really. The high 30s are just for along the coast today and tomorrow, and then it becomes cooler getting back into the 20s.
Right, okay. And any chance that it might start to heat up after that, or we might see more rain, or it's a bit too far out to tell?
Probably further inland will begin to heat up a good bit more with the dry weather on the way, but coastal areas should remain fairly cool.
All right, Brandon, thanks for that.
Thank you, Michael.
It's coming up to 25 minutes to one.
You're listening to The Country Hour.
On ABC Radio New South Wales.
Hello, I'm Stephanie Smale. Join me for The World Today. New South Wales Parliament recalled today to debate tough new laws in the wake of the Bondi shooting. Has the battle against AI cheating gone too far? Experts call for an overhaul in schools and universities. And Australia retains the Ashes in near record time. As the Aussies bask in glory, England does some soul searching. Those stories and more coming up on The World Today.
And on the text line, Tony's texted in from Mudgee to say he agrees that 10 guns are more than enough for farmers. He says he only has two, but now he only has one rifle. He used to have two, now he has one rifle. He says he'll be selling this hopefully after the buyback is announced. That's from Tony. Graham says we need a royal commission into the incompetence of ASIO and the New South Wales State Security Organisation, who are supposed to protect all people in Australia. The gun buyback is a political decision to look after, to make it look like they're doing something. The other guy, they arrested seven blokes in two cars that were driving around Bondi, but no arrests were made eventually, says Graham. And there's a few other texts coming through on the gun issue and shooters issue as well. Well, let's turn our attention to wine now. The federal government has today announced it will introduce a new mandatory code of conduct for wine grape purchases in an attempt to level the playing field for Australia's embattled wine industry. The code will apply to large winemakers in their dealings with growers and cover issues such as price deductions and dispute resolution. It's something that growers have long advocated for, arguing they need protection from what they describe as misconduct and unfair pricing behaviour. Selena Green has this report.
Australia's $51 billion wine industry has been in crisis for some time, with a global oversupply of wine and declining consumption rates creating an incredibly challenging market. For years, many grape growers say they've been getting prices well below the cost of production, and they've been calling for an enforceable code of conduct that would require the large companies that buy their grapes to release earlier indicative pricing and for a binding dispute resolution process. Today, the federal government says it's taken those calls on board, as well as the recommendations of a number of reviews, to make that a reality. Here's Agriculture Minister Julie Collins.
We have been talking about the long-term viability of the sector. We think that the wine code will address some of those, and we'll continue to look at the other recommendations and work with industry about what more needs to be done. The other thing I would say about the mandatory code is it does add a lot of transparency to the process in terms of making sure that there's written agreements, not just verbal agreements. It's about, as I said, levelling the playing field between the grape growers and the wine producers and making sure that there's more transparency in all of that process as they negotiate.
Australian Grape and Wine Chief Executive Lee McLean believes the mandatory code will bring certainty to the industry.
Well, it's a significant day for grape growers and winemakers in Australia. It is something that has been discussed for a number of years now. It is something that the ACCC has looked at, the federal government through Dr. Emerson's report has looked at as well, and I think most in the industry has considered in one way or another over that time period. So I think for the sake of getting some certainty for the industry, It's an important day for the sector, but there is a lot of work to do to make sure we get it right. One thing that is really important to note is that there isn't really a uniform idea of what a grape grower or a winemaker is. There are different business models across the sector. There are very different relationships that these businesses have with either their winery or their grape grower base. So what has changed over the last few years, though, is that we've seen a strong voluntary code of conduct that was introduced and developed by the industry. We saw a reasonable level of signatories get involved in that code, and that's helped lift the standard of the sector in those commercial dealings over the last few years. But what remains the case is that there are a number of wineries around the country that are not signatories to that voluntary code. And I think by implementing a mandatory set of circumstances like the government's talking about here, that will help to lift that standard and level the playing field.
And while he welcomes the code, Lee McLean agrees more needs to be done to pull the industry out of its current crisis.
I certainly wouldn't say it's a silver bullet, and I'm not sure there is a single silver bullet that is available to us at the moment. It's important to recognise that this mandatory code is being implemented, and this announcement is happening with the backdrop of the most challenging set of commercial conditions we've ever seen in this industry for grape growers and for winemakers as well, right across Australia. There are really severe issues in terms of demand dropping off globally. We've seen that manifest in instability in terms of some businesses in the wine side of things, but also really significant pressures for grape growers as well. So I think in the future, while a mandatory code and some of the other measures that the government is talking about may help along the way in terms of levelling out some of those commercial dealings, there is a lot more work to be done in terms of government and industry working together to try to resolve what seems to be, you know, a fairly catastrophic set of conditions for many producers around the country.
Australian Grape and Wine Chief Executive Lee McLean. Riverland Wine grape grower Jim Giagas welcomed today's announcement after what he describes as an incredibly tough year.
It's been a long time in the wait, over 20 years to get it across the board. So I'm glad it's there. It won't be set up for a while, but at least it's on its way. This year is probably one of the worst years on record, I would say, for grape growers. Not just grape growers, I think for the whole industry as a whole. People are suffering out there. You know, when you've got one in two growers on farmhouse hold support, it's not a good thing. It's very, very disturbing at the moment.
Riverland Wine grape grower Jim Giagas. The mandatory code will be enforced by the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission and will be developed in consultation with wine grape growers and winemakers. It'll come into effect on the 1st of January 2027.
That report from Selena Green, with additional reporting by Amelia Walters and Shannon Pierce. The ABC did reach out to two of the largest wineries that purchased grapes, Treasury Wine Estates and Vinicky, for a response, but both said that as signatories to the voluntary code, they welcome the government's announcement and would work with the government and stakeholders in the development of the mandatory code. And you can get more details at abc.net.au/rural. 18 minutes to one.
The Country Hour. Part of your community. And your life.
It's nostalgic.
For 80 years.
Hanging out with my brothers in the back of a ute.
The Country Hour.
They just naturally grow a beautiful shape.
Celebrating 80 years of telling rural stories on ABC Radio.
Well, it's been a milestone year for the rice industry, marking 100 years of commercial production. It's a crop with a farm gate value of more than $180 million a year, with more than 500 growers and employing thousands of people across the Riverina region and in southern New South Wales generally. But this year also marks a significant change in how rice crops are sold and marketed, with the full deregulation of the industry. Reporter Emily Doak has been trawling through the archives and speaking with people from the industry for this special report.
The first attempts to grow rice in Australia were in Queensland in the 1860s, then on the Manning River in northern New South Wales in the 1890s. But it was Japanese man Joe Takasuka who had early success in 1906 near Swan Hill in Victoria. He sold rice commercially in 1914 and continued to grow crops with mixed success for the next few decades. Meanwhile, further north in the Murrumbidgee irrigation area, there was growing interest in rice, cemented by a visit to California.
Mr. Brady, Jack Brady, was the manager of the Leighton Cannery, and he went to California to investigate fruit and how to grow fruit, really. That was the object of his mission. And when Mr. Brady was in California, he noticed the rice industry and the similarity of the soils and the climate, and he brought back some samples.
In 1924, eight farmers planted the first commercial crops of rice in the MIA, with seeds imported from California by the New South Wales government. About 225 tonnes of paddy was produced. The success of that first MIA crop saw more than 50 growers apply to plant more than 1,000 hectares of rice in 1925. By 1927, nearly 5,000 hectares was planted. Murrumbi rice grower Ian Dallenberg's family has a long association with the rice industry.
That photo is Dad with the binder. Used the binder to harvest the rice in 1927 on the Vance subdivision in Leighton.
Was your family one of the early adopters of rice in the region?
One of the first 100 that done it that year.
At just 14 years old, Ian was responsible for growing the family's rice crop in 1959.
We used to have about 50, 60 acres was all we were allowed to grow. It was all in bags, which averaged about 2 tonne to the acre, which that'd be nearly 2,000 bags of rice that had to be handled individually by about 5 different people.
In 1928, the Rice Marketing Board was established, the first statutory marketing authority in the state, and there's been some form of market regulation or vesting powers right up until this year.
Officials from the Rice Growers Cooperative Mills inspect the crop grown by Ken Mullins on the right. For this season, a new variety introduced from California has been grown for the first time.
The Rice Growers Cooperative Mills, which eventually became Rice Growers Limited, or Sunrice, was formed in 1950. Today, Sunrice is a global food company exporting to more than 50 countries. But getting access to those markets wasn't always easy.
That issue was being debated in Tokyo. We're very clear on what we want.
What Australia wants is access to the 400,000 tonnes of rice Japan must import under GATT.
The Japanese crop failed that year, and Australia's rice market has pounced.
At its peak, the Riverina rice industry produced more than 1.7 million tonnes from 150,000 hectares. But production is tied to water availability, and the millennium drought took the industry to the brink.
One of the country's largest food processors, Sunrice, is cutting 180 jobs in southern New South Wales in response to the ongoing drought.
For the first time in four generations of rice farming, Max Vag hasn't put in a crop this season.
No rice at all, no. Our irrigation allocation was 10%, so there certainly wasn't any water available for rice.
Former Sunrice chair Jerry Lawson describes the impact.
We recognised it was going to be impossible, that there was going to be no production, so we immediately stopped supplying the lower price markets internationally and carried over a very significant amount. So that enabled us to, if you like, look after the best markets. We also purchased rice from other places and took it to where we were the suppliers.
Although the rice industry is tight-knit, at times there's been fierce debate. One example was a proposed takeover of Sunrice in 2010.
Spanish food giant Ebro Foods has failed in its $600 million bid to take over local grower cooperative Sunrice.
It was seen by some as akin to selling the family farm, and the growers were deeply divided over the Spanish offer.
We had a duty to present that offer to the growers and the shareholders, and the vote was 68%, 69% in favour of taking the offer. It needed 75 to be successful. We were happy that we did what we had to do, which was present it. People got to decide whether they accepted or not. That's one of the great things about democracies.
Were you pleased to see it stay in grower and Australian hands? Reflecting back on it now?
If money's important. We'd have made more money going the other way, but I love what we've got.
While 98% of Australian rice is still grown in the New South Wales Riverina, the expansion of the industry in the northern rivers of New South Wales saw increased calls for deregulation of rice exports. That came for the northern industry in 2024 and in July 2025 for the Riverina. The current rice crop in southern New South Wales is the first for a newly deregulated export market. There's low water allocations and reduced production, as well as more buybacks to recover water for the environment. But former Sunrise Chair Laurie Arthur says although there's challenges ahead, the rice industry is well positioned to take them on.
We'll always have a strong rice industry in the Riverina, but it'll be a smaller industry. But because we're so efficient, we can still make money when we get water at a reasonable price.
That's Laurie Arthur, the former Sunrise Chairman, ending that report on the history of rice growing. 100 years, that report put together by Emily Doak. You're listening to the New South Wales Country Hour. Well, let's go from rice to sugar, because the outgoing boss of Sunshine Sugar says that the biggest challenge in his nearly 18 years in the role was the 2022 floods, a natural disaster that cost an estimated $50 million in damage to its three sugar mills on the New South Wales north coast. Prior to his appointment leading the New South Wales sugar milling and refinery operation, Chris Connors was the CEO of Proserpine Sugar Milling Cooperative in North Queensland. But now, he says, due to health reasons, he's reluctantly retiring from the sugar business after a number of decades. Kim Honan sat down with him for one final conversation.
Came here quite unknowing what I was getting into. New South Wales Sugar was always known as somebody, a group that would have a go. So relying on that, at the end of the day, we've had a go. We've done a whole lot of different things. You've got to have a different vision, in my view, in the sugar industry, in Australia in particular, but the world. If you sit there and simply rely on world sugar prices, you're going to be in trouble. And a small business like us, and people think we're good size, but you've got three small sugar mills, and you've just got to look at Queensland and see the number of small mills that are shut down. And it's all because of throughput and no diversification. So the fact that we've diversified, we've put in that refinery, we've got low GI sugar, there's a bunch of things that we've done that all add to the bottom line. And if we weren't doing that, we would be shut down. I'm very sure of it.
Yeah, mills in Queensland that have shut down or been taken over by foreign companies. Were you pretty determined that that wasn't going to happen on your watch? Were you open to it? Did you knock back some offers?
Yeah, we did knock back some offers at the end of the day. And we went out looking to see what the offers would be. And in the end, that restructure we did with Manildra was our answer in the end. That's why we thought it'd be best to go, maintain the ownership in Australia, maintain ownership with a partner that we knew. And when you put the two parts of the business together, it made sense.
And in the 17 years in the top job, what would you say your biggest challenge has been?
Oh, the floods of 2022. At the end of the day, you just got to look at what it cost us. So it was $50 million over the three mills, but Broadwater in particular was up in the $20 millions. For the guys who have got that Broadwater sugar mill up and running to be able to do the crushing, and we started that in August, where we normally would have started in late June or early July, for them to have gone through all of that process to get that plant back up and running was just a fantastic job. And the pressure that was sitting on them to be able to get it done was pretty big. So that was probably the biggest challenge we've had. I mean, overall, I think the way we were pricing our sugar and that right at the start needed change, and we did that, and it's made a big difference to what the refinery is able to deliver from a profit perspective. And when you put the refinery and the whole milling operations in context, without that refinery, we wouldn't be here. But the overall business, when you look at it, it's all related. from the grower through the mills to the refinery out to the customer.
Do you have any regrets of your time in the industry? Is there anything that you wish you could have or should have done differently?
Not really. I mean, at the end of the day, when I first came here, I went out to shed meetings and told them my thoughts about everything, told them what I wanted to do, and I said to them at the time, what we'll do is, this is what I'm going to do, and this is what we're going to do, and when we do it, you'll know why we did it, and then if we stuff it up, you'll still know why we did it, but we'll be open with you. So we've been really open with everything that we've done. Yeah, we're never going to do it perfectly. There's always going to be issues that the growers don't agree with us on. But if you're fair to them and you're honest, they're not going to burn you. You'll end up with a lot of good friends if you do it the right way. And that's what we've done.
And what do you think it will take to keep Sunshine Sugar Australian-owned?
Just do what we're doing. You know, at the end of the day, I expect that sugar prices are going to fall in a hole soon. They have started to. It's just inevitable. It's the way the world sugar price is. So it'll get back down to 12 or 13 cents for a little while. We've got a really strong hedge program in place that just overcomes all that for the next 2 years. And then after that, you've got to make sure that you're getting the refinery operating in a way that delivers the profits that you need, and B, that your hedge program picks up on the opportunities out there to put the right price in place. If you do that, you'll make sure your growers are looked after as well as the business, and then the refinery can deliver what you need.
Chris Connors, who finishes up this year as the CEO of Sunshine Sugar. Well, back to the gun debate. Australia's peak ag industry body, the National Farmers Federation, is calling for calm and considered firearms reform following the horrific attack at Bondi in New South Wales. The Liberal Party's announced it will support the state government's first bill in response to the Bondi terror attack, giving the legislation a pathway through both houses. The changes would see tighter gun laws, including restrictions on the number of firearms that someone can own and more frequent license checks. Meanwhile, the federal government will establish a national gun buyback scheme to purchase surplus, newly banned and illegal firearms, the largest since the Howard government in 1996. NFF President Hamish McIntyre is talking here about the gun laws with Megan Hughes.
Firstly, Megan, farmers all right across Australia were absolutely devastated by the events at Bondi, and understand the community who put safety as a high priority, and we do too. But at the same time, we just need to emphasise that firearms are an essential tool of trade for farmers right across Australia, but also people that live and work in our regional communities that help us control feral pests on our properties as required and when required. And we always will support sensible reform, but we just caution against doing anything in a rush manner and heavy-handed changes that also can create unintended consequences for farmers. So we just want to reviews done sensibly and consider all things, but we need to understand that reforms were done back in the Howard era, you know, have been very effective for rural and regional Australia, we believe. So any changes going forward hopefully will be very minor for agriculture. It needs to be looked at separately to how firearms are, you know, managed and stored in our big cities around Australia.
So New South Wales, out of all the states, is the first one to put through reforms. Having a look at what they've done, which is limiting the number of firearms per person. The cap, though, is different from a regular person to a sport shooter or to a primary producer, and also extra conditions around storage and licensing. Are there any concerns at the moment of what that particular state is doing?
Look, we're still considering everything that they are considering, and we haven't seen the final details. New South Wales, obviously, are the state due to the terrible murders that occurred there last Sunday, working more quickly on reform. So, look, when we see the absolute detail, and we might know more this afternoon, we will make further comment then, Megan. New South Wales Farmers Federation are working with the government, so hopefully the changes that do come forward have very minimal effect, if any effect, on farmers. But again, as I said, we do support sensible reform. If there's things that are shown out that we can live with farmers, I'm sure, you know, in the interest of the broader community safety, we will we'll be very, you know, open to considering them. But at the moment, we haven't got the final detail.
What does successful consultation with the agricultural industry look like to you?
That we are engaged in the process of reform and policy as it evolves, so as it's discussed, it's much easier for all to work collectively together as new legislation, new policy is developed, so that you know, it's a win-win then for government and regional Australia. So it's about working closely together as it's created, I believe, is essential, just so we don't have politics getting in the road of what actually the community needs in this area.
NFF President Hamish McIntyre, you're listening to The Country Hour. We're heading up to news time.